Morning. Samsara, the world of suffering and confusion and daily life, living and dying, and grasping and averting. Samsara is nirvana. They're closer than that. Just as form and emptiness. I can only get my fingers so close, you know? If I could get them closer, I would. Same with samsara and nirvana. Sometimes instead of saying form is emptiness, we just say form is form. Emptiness is emptiness. Because each one contains all. And as soon as you say form is emptiness, you're separating them. Don't do that. Samsara is nirvana. And that's one way of understanding the Heart Sutra. All those no's, we've been chanting it in Japanese in the morning, all those mu. I thought about asking somebody to count them. How many times mu shows up in the Japanese version, Makahanya, Haramita, Shingyo. Title is the great, the full title is the Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra. We just call it the Heart Sutra for short, but it's wisdom beyond wisdom. There's, as Mel used to talk about it, there's a pivot that happens. And that pivot shows up as an empty heart. Heart Sutra is reminding us to let go of all of our attachments and to stop giving substance to everything, to stop reifying everything. That's what all those no's are. It's also particularly addressed to another early school, the Sarvastivadins, who had decided after they made so many lists that there must some of them be permanent and have an essence. Well, no. That's the Heart Sutra. No. Give it up. And I think of the ox herding pictures, which is a famous Zen teaching. There's usually 10 pictures. And it starts out with a young woman, monk, going along and she sees some ox, water buffalo hoof prints. And she goes searching. And that's the first picture she's starting to look for. And then she catches her water buffalo. But it's very obstreperous. So she puts the ring in its nose and she attaches a stout rope and she pulls it along. You understand this is not about an ox or a water buffalo. She pulls it along and she struggles with it. And finally, after a while, it comes along and follows her. When she has it, she holds the other end of the rope. It will follow her without being obstreperous. And then she learns to harmonize with it. And because somebody's texting and she learns to harmonize with it. And then there's usually a picture of she's lying on its back and she's facing the tail. She's not even directing it. And maybe she's playing a flute and they are just going along together. And then there's a picture maybe of plum blossoms, something like that. And then the next picture is either totally blank or it's got an Enzo, you know, that's a Zen circle, meaning emptiness. But that's not the last picture. That's not true nirvana. In the ox herding pictures, the monk returns to the marketplace. Sometimes there's a picture, she's just sitting by a hearth, sort of idly. A friend of mine did some doodles. They're wonderful. They're in the library, but it's too, the line's too fine to show it to you now. But he was a tea master, a teacher of tea. And he did some doodles probably during study period at Tassajara. At any rate, one of them shows him making tea. And I think it says, yippee. So he's back to the world being useful. And that's samsara is nirvana. That's after making that pivot, letting go of all of the extra, then daily life becomes nirvana. An empty heart becomes available. And I wish that I thought we all stayed there once we made that pivot, but I don't think that. I haven't seen that. It is possible to make that pivot so that your wisdom becomes what's called luminous mirror wisdom. It simply reflects things as it is. It sees clearly. The Prajnaparamita sees clearly. She's an organ of vision. And an empty heart knows clearly and responds. And that pivot is available, it's doable. Sometimes it's hard work because it entails looking at one's prejudices, one's closely held views, one's self-protectiveness, one's aversion. Sometimes it feels like the heart is just like this, you know, and that the work is actually prying it open. Not violently, but, you know, it just feels hard. Yeah. I don't want to look at my small-mindedness. I don't want to look at my ancient tangled family karma wounds. I don't want to. Deeply, my vow, on a level of vow, my vow is to do that homework. Look and to let go of the self-concern and to allow the ego to, the ego, I've been talking about it, about that, you know, that we have the ego as if it's this beach ball in front of us, to let it deflate to maybe a softball down here. Yes, like that. And it doesn't mean beating yourself up. It doesn't mean, you know, like, you know, suddenly puncturing the beach ball and having it kind of explode or take off like a balloon that you untie. Gently. Gently. And it gets, I think it gets easier. But that doesn't mean it's always easy. It isn't. This is our practice. This is seeing clearly. This is saying, this is awakening that Bodhi mind that wants to know the truth. Well, it isn't just the truth of the vastness of emptiness. It's the truth of, I hate Donald Trump and it troubles me. I do. I need to have a difficult conversation next week with an old, old friend of my sister's and mine. And I might owe her an apology. It's painful to contemplate. And I know I need to tell her how hurt I was by something she did when my sister was dying. Can I do that with an empty heart, without piling it on at how hurt I was? Because I was plain old hurting, and it had nothing to do with her, how much I was hurting. And she, I'd say inadvertently, added to it. So it's very much in my heart, in my body, mind, to do the homework, to let it hurt the way it hurt, the way it hurts now. And then let it clarify itself to me. My job is to stay open to it and to keep my eyes open. And sometimes an open heart simply manifests a generous gesture. Or Steve spoke about standing up for a smaller classmate who was being bullied by a larger classmate in, it was elementary school or maybe middle school, and Steve had been bullied by that same guy, but when he went after the smaller student, Steve jumped in and said, "Stop it, leave him alone." And he didn't think about it at the time, but he just did it. And then afterwards, he thought, oh, I didn't know I would do that. I didn't know I don't know that you use this phrase, but like, I didn't know I had that in me. That's an empty heart responding. An empty heart is not a philosophical concept or construct. And it's not something that arises because you say, I'm going to have an empty heart. To which I respond, well, whoop-de-doo. Because The Heart Sutra says, no, 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 no. Let go, let go, let go, let go. Whatever you think, don't believe it. And that's not easy. It's not easy to see what you think and feel when you're about letting it go. Egos are very wily things. It's a very sweet and prosaic notion, an empty heart. And when you make that pivot, when you do open the hand, there's joy there, there's delight. You don't go somewhere else. You don't disappear into emptiness. Maybe you do, but you come back to the marketplace. That's our practice. And you find out what's there. And it's a joyous. It may not be fun. But when you get to the point where you're willing to just be another human being, that is nirvana. So we have been talking about this various ways in various forums. I want to know what you think of this. I've been talking about it at some in Doksan, and people sometimes set themselves up for, make it into a thing and make it so daunting that it's not available. It's like, thinking to be a bodhisattva, you have to be Avalokiteshvara. Well, that's not going to happen. Most likely. Maybe some of you will be Avalokiteshvara. Who knows? But let's assume that's not going to happen. So does that mean you don't let go? You don't arouse the spark that wants to know? No. Arouse the spark that wants to know. No, it doesn't mean that. And so I'm asking, how do you understand an empty heart? What does this mean to you? Kelly?
There we go. I could just shout across. I've been thinking about this a lot lately because of both the class and discussion with you and things. In some ways, I kind of think of the idea of an actually completely empty heart as an impossible place to be, and yet worth striving for. And I think for me, I've been trying to kind of work on the idea of, well, it's not, I can't empty it out entirely, but it's okay that might be the idea of the perfection of that is impossible. Like the striving is the important thing. Though I do think about, like Steve's example was wonderful from the class, the one you just repeated, and I thought about that a lot. And those few times when like situations had happened where I've reacted in a way that was uncharacteristically noble and brave, and realized that I reacted because I didn't take the time to process anything that would have clouded it. I just reacted. To me, that's kind of almost a taste of the empty heart is just reacting, doing the right thing without that reaction being clouded by at least much else. Anyway, these are just the kind of things that were swimming around in my head.
I'm going to quibble a little. One thing, I prefer the word responding.
Mm-hmm. To reacting.
Yeah. But also, and I think that you do have access to an empty heart in those kind of situations, which I think of as a generous response. But there are also a lot of times when you have to do homework to get there, and you can get there, you know, but not perfect. No, of course not. You know, and your ego is still functioning, and you're functioning in the relative world because you have to. But you can get there. And that's, for me, it's often when I have acted unskillfully and I need to apologize. And, can I get to, I'm sorry, I was rude, rather than, I was really triggered by you the other day because you said X to me, and I'm sorry I got triggered. Well, that's not, I'm sorry if you were upset. No, that's not an apology.
Yeah.
You know, the impulse is to justify oneself or to go on and explain why you were rude, which, you know, maybe it has to do with that person, but maybe it has to do with your ancient angled family, whatever, or like that cop said about the man who murdered 8 people in Atlanta, you know, he's having a bad day, which is a comment, you know, I realize that. I just know, went ahead anyway. But at any rate, to get to the point of just saying, I'm sorry, I was rude to you. You know, and if you need to have a conversation about it, you know, if the person actually did something unskillful and they hurt you, that's another conversation. Maybe the next day, depending on maybe what response you get to what you say. But to just say it, and for that to be enough, without any expectation of a response, without saying it in a way that demands a response, just, I'm sorry, I was rude to you. That's an empty heart. And it's not easy to get there. And sometimes maybe you do it, you say the words and you mean it, but you know that you're holding something. You know, you do the best you can, and you don't apologize until you're ready, right? You know, it happens in relationships a lot. You know, if you've had a fight and you go back and try to talk it out before you're ready, it's not a good idea.
Well, talking it out and apologizing are kind of two different things.
That's right, but you know, but I'm just saying, you don't apologize before you're ready, because you're just going to make it worse. And, but ready might be, you know, 85% of an empty heart. So do the 85% wholeheartedly, because you can probably do enough. I don't know. I had never thought about it that way before, but when you said about perfect, I don't know that I'm perfect, but I have done it a number of times, and it's hard. You know, it's hard getting there because there are things I don't want to look at.
Yeah.
You know, I usually get triggered when I'm frightened, so, and I don't want to be with that. You know, I get angry and aggressive when I'm frightened, and, you know, I'm a lawyer. It's easy for me to do.
I think it makes a lot of sense. Like apology work. Yeah, and which is a term I just made up. But apology work is kind of, it's really useful, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. Yes, it's a great, it's useful for you to do it. Useful in relation to the other person, but it's useful work, as you see. And I often talk and kind of let this tape run, and whining about the person, or in my mind to the person, and you did this, and you did this, and then it starts getting to, you did it to me. Me, and then I often start laughing. But I need to do that. It's this infantile response, the self-protection. And I need to kind of take care of her, that little girl that felt disrespected. Anyway. Oh, and striving. Not striving doesn't work either. Doing the work to uncover it. And so you put your intention on paying attention, not on getting somewhere. Barbara Joan?
Been thinking a lot about this idea of conversation for a long time, and the idea of apologizing or repenting and confessing in a relationship. And I think there's a way in which a great deal of the work is the self conversation. So I have a very difficult relationship with my father, one in which we are not speaking in for a long time, which is like a year, more than a year, and this has gone on throughout my life. And the danger of confronting or even apologizing is so high psychically and personally and interpersonally that I have chosen not to, even after looking many times at my role in the breakdown, in the last breakdown of the connection. And so much of the work has been looking at the ways in which I catered to the dynamic to my own detriment for so long that in order to be true to myself and true to open-heartedness, I had to also acknowledge and continuously have to, the damaging dangers of that dynamic. And as long as he and I are both alive, there's always an opportunity for that to change and shift. But and certainly I always hope for it. But every time I get close to thinking I'm gonna approach that place in an interpersonal way, I have to remind myself of that danger. And I think that's some of the most painful work in untangling, as you called it, the entangled family karma. And the remnant wounds of the child self and the adult child of that, and the ways in which I've acted that out and been reactive through my life, and instead of trying to leap ahead and apologize in a situation where there's not, where I know historically there's not going to be a change, because if I apologize, that's expecting a change. That's not likely. How so this constant reminding the selves, the multiple selves, that staying still and feeling the sorrow and the loss and the brokenness of it is nirvana, I guess you could call it, that is reality. And that, yeah, so I would love to hear what your reflection?
Well, one is an empty heart apologizes without expecting anything. And getting to that is really hard. And the work is looking at this one, looking at this one, and looking at the expectation or the desire, you know, for a response. You know, the little kid wants love and affection and whatever, you know, and you have to, it's useful to do that work, to look at oneself and say, you know, what's my part in this? What in me is getting triggered? What am I afraid of? How is it in my gut? Am I willing to feel the fear? Am I willing to experience the anger? Am I willing to experience the hurt? And do your own homework. And then it's like you just keep turning towards it and ask, what is it? What's going on here? And not thinking about it in your brain, but feeling it in your body, experiencing it in your gut. And then the appropriate response may well reveal itself to you. And it may be the appropriate response has got to include the possibility that you should not reach out. That isn't, there's not some particular answer for everybody. But the intention, the use of the perfection of wisdom, the use of your organ of vision, which isn't just your eyes, that is the process. And it's very important and useful. That's the pivot. When you can know these things, know them intuitively, know them with your prajna wisdom, not your brain, then there's a lightness to it. And it may be that you approach the other person or write them a letter or something. It may be that you don't. And nobody can decide that for you. But doing the homework to get to a empty heart is the useful work. So we have a few more minutes. Are there any other remarks or thoughts or experiences? Are we in Sashin mind that you're all just quiet? I don't know. I see some interesting facial expressions. Lisa?
Since we've been talking about empty heart during the whole class, I went back and read something that Trungpa Rinpoche wrote about it. And I have a very complicated relationship with that teacher. He wrote a wonderful thing about empty heart. And I could summarize it or I could read it. Which do you prefer?
Well, how long is it?
It's not too long, like a page and a half, a page, a short page like that.
Oh, okay. Why don't you read it? Whichever you prefer, actually.
When you awaken, I'll just start here. When you awaken your heart in this way, you find to your surprise that your heart is empty. You find that you are looking into outer space. What are you? Who are you? Where is your heart? If you really look, you won't find anything tangible and solid. Of course, you might find something very solid if you have a grudge against someone or you have fallen passionately in love, but that is not awakened heart. If you search for awakened heart, if you put your hand through your rib cage and feel for it, there is nothing there except for tenderness. You feel sore and soft. And if you open your eyes to the rest of the world, you feel tremendous sadness. This kind of sadness doesn't come from being mistreated. You don't feel sad because someone has insulted you or because you feel impoverished. Rather, this experience of sadness is unconditioned. It occurs because your heart is completely exposed. There is no skin or tissue covering it. It is pure, raw meat. Even if a tiny mosquito lands on it, you feel so touched. Your experience is raw and tender and so personal. The genuine heart of sadness comes from feeling that your non-existent heart is full. You would like to spill your heart's blood, give your heart to others. For the warrior, this experience of sad and tender heart is what gives birth to fearlessness. Conventionally, being fearless means that you are not afraid of this, of that, or if someone hits you, you will hit him back. However, we are not talking about that street fighter level of fearlessness. Real fearlessness is the product of tenderness. It comes from letting the world tickle your heart, your raw and beautiful heart. You're willing to open up without resistance or shyness and face the world. You are willing to share your heart with others. I think that's a good definition.
Oh yeah, but I don't remember, you know, now I've talked, you know, given these lectures in the class and talked to individuals. So, but, you know, I was talking, I think it was the first day, about that compassion grows out of wisdom. Mm. It grows out of emptiness. It grows out of knowing that openness. Not vulnerability, but openness. Mm. And I don't particularly resonate with the warrior part. But I know he doesn't mean it in the sense of whopping people. But that heart that just responds. We can get there. But we don't live there, but we can get there. It's uncovering it. So it's time to stop. We have Shosan at the schedule says 3:15, but by the time we get organized, it'll probably be more like 3:25. So Lisa, just come as soon as you can. And everybody in the session has done this before, I think. Right? Dana, you've done it. Yes? Okay.
Beings are numberless. I evolve.